Welcome to the Psychology Podcast, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. I'm Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, and in each episode, I have a conversation with a guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Christian Miller on the podcast. Dr. Miller is A.C. Reid Professor of Philosophy at Wake Forest University and Director of the Character Project, funded by the John Templeton Foundation and Templeton World Charity Foundation. He is the author of over 75 papers, as well as the author of Moral Character, an Empirical Theory, Character, and Moral Psychology, and most recently the book The Character Gap, How Good Are We? Hey, Christian, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
So how good are we really?
Well, that's a big question to start us off right away.
Out of the gate.
Yeah, right. Let's not mess around. So one question is, what does good mean here? And what are our standards that we're going to be used to evaluate whether someone is good or not? Another question is who the we is. And then another question still is, what source of evidence am I going to be using to decide how good are we? But let me all say something briefly on each of those. So the good I have in mind here when we say how good are we is virtuous. So I'm a philosopher who works in the area of ethics. And within area of ethics, there's a longstanding tradition to think about good people and bad people in terms of the kind of character they have and whether they're virtuous people or vicious people. And so I could say a lot more about what I mean by a virtue or a vice, but just to put that on the table, when I say, how good are we, I'm thinking about how virtuous are we. The we I have in mind here tends to be contemporary people, so I'm not saying throughout history, tends to be Westerners, because the source of evidence I'm drawing on tends to focus on just Western populations, and it tends to be adults as opposed to children. And then the last part of it is, what's the source of evidence that I'm going to be using? That's where you come in. So that's where psychology helps me out. Looking at studies that have been done in social and personality psychology over the last 50 years or so, roughly speaking, which put people into different situations, morally relevant situations. I'm looking at moral character here, and see how they tend to behave. Do they cheat or not cheat? Do they lie or not lie? Do they steal or not steal? Do they help or not help? And so we can dive into the particular studies, but to tie all that together then, using the research that I'm familiar with in psychology, which tends to focus on contemporary Western populations, and using the ethical standards of virtue and vice, my conclusion now, to not evade the question anymore, is that most of us are a mixed bag. By that I mean we have some aspects of our character which are morally positive, and some aspects of our character which are morally negative. But in general, most people, I'm not saying everyone, there are outliers, this is a kind of a bell curve kind of situation. Most people, given my reading of the data, have a character which is not good enough to count as virtuous. But on the flip side, it's not bad enough to count as vicious. So we're somewhere in a murky middle between the two.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I recently did this paper. We looked at the light versus dark triad of personality. We created a light triad scale to be a nice counterpart to the dark triad scale, which consists of psychopathy, Machiavellism, and narcissism. And we found, consistent with what you're saying, we looked at a light versus dark triad balance within individuals. Mm-hmm. Kind of calculate what are most people like, their light and dark force? What is it in the average human? And we actually empirically tried to answer that question. And we found that most people are like slightly tipped to the right of lightness. But it's like basically empirically confirms exactly what you just said.
Okay, great. And then, was that more with self-report measures?
That was based on self-report measures, but we also correlated the light triad with performance measures of conspicuous consumption and cheating and stuff, greed, yeah.
I look forward to the paper and all the support I can get, I welcome it.
So. Great. So, well, we have a lot to talk about because you initiated this project called the Character Project. I'd like to hear some of the main findings, the main takeaways from the Character Project, and who were the sample?
Right.
So, who were in the sample? Yeah.
Right. So this is quite a large project that had many different facets to it. So let me kind of paint a picture and then we can go in different directions if you like. This was a 5-year project based at Wake Forest University, where I am, funded by the Templeton Foundation, as you mentioned. And it had a component of research at Wake Forest. And then it had another component, which was funding research at other universities around the world. So we actually became a kind of mini grant-making institute ourselves, where we had researchers in psychology, philosophy, and theology apply with proposals for new and innovative work on the topic of character. They applied to us. We had, had their proposals reviewed and funded the best ones we received. So we ended up funding 28 scholars around the world, very interesting products in psychology especially. But then also there was the aspect of what we did here at Wake Forest. And by we, I mean myself. I was the one heading it up in the philosophy department, but with a team of other people, including some prominent personality psychologists like William Fleeson, Mike Furr, and Arana Jayawardenam, in our psychology department here. So the psychologists here did a number of empirical studies. And in my own case, I was doing what I planned to explore a little bit already with you, that kind of interdisciplinary work at the intersection of philosophy and psychology. So where philosophy was going to be informing me as to what a good life is and what it is to be a virtuous person. And then the psychological research was going to be informing me as to the extent to which people tend to live up to those standards of what it is to be a good person. And so in my own case, that ended up resulting in the two academic books that you mentioned in your introduction, Character and Moral Psychology and Moral Character and Empirical Theory. So the overall takeaway, I think, and we can get into the specific findings of different projects, the overall takeaway is that we really wanted to infuse a lot of excitement and energy and resources into the study of character in these three disciplines. We thought, you know, there's some work going on already, but not much. And we wanted to kind of incentivize and get people paying more attention to it. Now that the project is over and it's been over for a couple of years now, we've seen lots more work coming out in the area of character. And that's one of the great rewards that I'm most proud of.
That is great. You gave really great context behind the study. Did you tell me some of the key takeaways of the study? Did I miss that?
Yeah, so it's hard to say that there's any one study.
Oh, okay.
Because, so, you know, we had my books, we had the psychology research at Wake Forest, we had the products that were funded elsewhere. I'll mention, how about I just give you a couple highlights?
Yes, the highlight reel.
So one psychology product we funded was at University of Barcelona by David Gallardo. And he was doing a virtual reality simulation of the Milgram experiment. So since you can't do Milgram anymore these days for, you know, ethical reasons, he had this kind of innovative thought of using this virtual reality lab that he has there to simulate in many ways the real study, but without a person, quote unquote, getting the shocks, instead of virtual reality avatar who was getting the shocks in the shock
experience. Is that ecologically valid?
Well, that's good. Good question to ask him. He made the case that it was. And I was, you know, at the time, this was 6-7 years ago, I was convinced by his arguments. And the findings tended to mirror, for whatever this is worth, tend to mirror those that Milgram found himself. So roughly the same percentage of participants would go up to the XXX shock level as compared to those who wouldn't go that high. So that's one illustration of the kind of product we studied in psychology. Another one was looking at, from a developmental perspective, at when is there evidence fairness norms emerging in young infants? You know, at what stage can we kind of detect that they pay attention to fairness norms? And this researcher suggested it could be as early as 9 months based upon her behavioral work. A third researcher, Sarah Conrath, was looking at ways to encourage empathy. And she was using a text message intervention. To see whether by receiving text messages periodically during the day, which had empathetic themes to them, that might be effective in cultivating empathy in the participants, and then subsequently leading them to behave better on a helping task than a control group, which did not receive empathy-inducing texts. And she found some preliminary evidence that was the case. So that's why I struggled when you said what's the results of the study. Here are three very different studies with, you know, very different goals in mind. but all under the broad heading of investigating character from an empirical perspective.
Yeah, no, I totally hear you. So is there a website where people can read up about the summaries of all the findings?
Yeah, that's great. So we have a website, www.thecharacterproject.com. And we have summaries. We also have videos. We have speaking at a conference, the participants, and summarizing their results. And we have links to the published works as well.
So it seems like you're defining character as tinged with morality, whereas a lot of people in the field of positive psychology, you know, who use the VIA personality strengths inventory, a lot of those character strengths are not necessarily tinged with morality. In fact, you could have a character strength for, let's say, authenticity and be authentic in being an asshole, right?
Right.
So why do you choose to define character in the way you have chosen it? Do you have criticism on how others have chosen to define it?
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Great question.
Thanks.
So let me be a little clearer, and I think actually I'm going to agree with your point. So the one broad category here could be personality traits. Under the heading of personality traits, you might say that one species is character traits.
Okay.
And then under the heading of character traits, you might say there's one species are moral character traits,
okay,
morally relevant character traits. So I do agree that character traits are broader than just the morally relevant ones.
Okay.
Some people try to classify them and divide them into different kinds. So, for example, some people say that there are epistemic character traits, those character traits that have to do with theoretical inquiry, theoretical knowledge and wisdom and understanding and the like. Others will say that there are character traits associated with aesthetics and beauty. Others, character traits associated with athletics. And then there are the moral ones, too. So I don't mean to conflate character traits just with the moral ones. I think that's quite right to say that they're a kind of character trait. For me, I just chose in my own research to focus on the morally relevant ones. I had to start somewhere. I'm an ethics professor. That's what I do. So, you know, it seems natural to start with those. So when I say things like most people's character is neither virtuous or vicious, what I mean here is moral character. I'm speaking to that specifically.
Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty common approach to take.
I think so as well. Yeah. Just wanted to take this moment to thank you all for your support of the podcast over the years. It's been a real privilege to do this podcast for you all for the past 4 years. It's been a real labor of love. If you'd like to further support the podcast, I wanted to let you know a few things you could do to help make it a better experience for you all. First, I'd really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. This would help make the show more prominent on iTunes and increase our listenership. I believe you can subscribe both on your iPhone and on your computer. Second, it'd be great if you could give the show a rating and review on iTunes. I definitely read all the reviews, and they're helpful to others who are thinking about giving the show a listen. Another thing you can do is donate something to the show. Even just the price of a cup of coffee would really help me continue to do this podcast for you all. To donate something, you can go to thepsychologypodcast.com and click on the link at the bottom that says Become a Sponsor. So thanks again for your incredible support of the show over the years. You know, I do this show for you all because I truly love sharing my enthusiasm and love of the mind, brain, and creativity, and I really appreciate you joining me on this journey. Okay, now back to the show. Let's talk philosophically about definitions here and boundary conditions. Can we precisely delineate where something fits within the realm of a character trait, personality trait, versus a non-character personality trait? So are the big five, they're not usually treated as character traits.
Uh-huh.
Philosophically, why not? Can you justify or explain to me why extroversion, introversion dimension of personality is not a character dimension, but let's say bravery, non-bravery is? And doesn't it get murky when you start to like really think about it
and realize
that bravery is strongly correlated with extroversion? So in a sense, you are saying that, you know, okay, do you see what I'm saying? It gets complicated.
I surely do. So I don't know if I can, you know, give you what you want, but here are some thoughts at least. One thought is that when people say that, you know, the big five are not dealing with character, what they typically mean is moral character here. So they're saying they're big five traits and their facets, and then they'll say there's moral character traits, and then they'll say, well, we don't see much moral character in the big five. Maybe under agreeableness, we might say there's modesty, and maybe there's some kind of helping going on, but by and large, there doesn't seem to be much moral character in the big five or its facets on a surface reading. And that's, I think, a fair point to make. But there's a deeper question that you're asking here, which is, can we kind of give a precise criteria to distinguish, say, moral character on the one side from non-moral personality on the other. I don't know if we can, but I'll at least mention one or two attempts. So one attempt is to focus on the topic of responsibility and to say that our character traits are those for which it's appropriate to hold someone morally responsible or not. When we think about other personality traits that are not moral character traits, we wouldn't necessarily have to hold someone responsible for possessing them. So to take your example, someone's level of extroversion or introversion, it wouldn't seem to be appropriate to hold someone morally responsible for that. But someone's level of honesty or compassion or maybe even temperance, it would be appropriate to hold someone morally responsible for those traits. So I'm not saying this is a perfect proposal, but I'm saying it's one that's out there that's been proposed to draw this kind of criteria.
I'm trying to like wrap my head around that. So it gets tricky when you like with the VIA 24 character strengths, Some of them are treated as independent of each other. And what gets tricky about that is if you're extroverted, you're probably going to be more likely to, like, I'm really trying to think the relationship between personality and character strengths. So if you're more extroverted, you're going to be like much more likely to report zest as one of your character strengths. If you're more introverted, you're going to be more likely to select humility. We found this in our own research we did with Susan Cain and some other particular subset of character strengths. So yet, when we look at the big five, you know, we'll say like, oh, there's a distinction here between personality and character. You know, like the introversion, extroversion dimension is amoral. But we actually have on the VIA, we have different sources of variation that can kind of actually conflict. And I don't know if that's problematic at all.
So you're thinking that in the case of the VIA, what's looked like perhaps some non-moral traits do tend to be strongly correlated with some relatively uncontroversial moral traits. And so it's hard to draw any sharp boundaries in a classification.
I don't know what I'm really saying, because I love the VIA in the sense that I found it really useful for a lot of people to take it and find their top strengths. You know, so much of life and self-actualization, in my view, is helping people find how they want to live their own best life in their own way without giving them, you know, their own sort of like, you know, rules. And they have to kind of discover that and discover it for themselves. And the VIA is a nice way to help people discover some sides of themselves. But it's, you know, maybe it's just too pedantic. I'm being too pedantic in trying to think through, well, what is a absolutely non-character personality trait, you know? And like, why is zest a character trait when it's essentially big five extroversion or one facet of extroversion? I mean, it is. Zest is almost perfect correlated with positive enthusiasm, which is one of the two main aspects of extroversion.
Yeah, so I wonder, this is maybe just getting semantic at this point.
It might be, and I might be way too pedantic, even more so than a philosopher.
So, I mean, it was called the character strengths. The 24 character strengths. I wonder how much is packed into the notion of character there in character strengths. I mean, another way to think about this that might be helpful is, you know, if we're thinking about, is something a part of moral character or not? Can we kind of draw boundaries around the realm of moral character? Well, take a given trait and vary it, strengthen it or weaken it. Does that change our moral assessment of the person or not? For something like zest, I would think that initially the answer would be no. I mean, increase someone's zest or decrease someone's zest, that's not going to change how I would morally assess or appraise the person. But you take something like honesty and increase someone's honesty or decrease someone's honesty, that does change my overall assessment of the morality of that person's character. So that might be another way to helpfully think about trying to draw the boundaries of moral character.
Yeah, so I hear what you're saying. Within the character strengths space, there's a subset that are related to moral character. Yeah, that's all you're really saying. Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense. I'm going to move on from my pedanticism and ask you, you know, you looked at what our character looks like today in various dimensions, helping, harming, lying, and cheating. Can we talk about them? Can we start with helping? You know, where are people at these days in terms of helping?
Sure. So figure that out from the armchair. I'm a philosopher. Yeah, I like to do a lot of things from the armchair. It'd be great if I could arrive at all these answers without having to get weighed into the empirical literature. But for something like that, I need the empirical literature. So I would look at, on the one hand, studies which found that people didn't help very much. And I would then, on the other hand, look at studies which found that people helped quite a bit. And I would kind of examine what factors would predict whether the participants would tend to help or not. So my ultimate goal there is to think, is people's helping tracking the morally relevant considerations or not? Are people helping in light of the correct moral considerations, and are they not helping in light of the correct moral considerations or not? So that's the abstract answer. Now to get into some of the specifics. So I'll give you two studies on opposite ends of the spectrum. On the one hand, we have something like group effect studies, where, you know, to take one of the classic examples, lady in distress, 1969, participants come into the lab. One at a time, they go into a room. They're told to fill out a survey. A stranger joins them in the room filling out the survey. So the two of them are hard at work. The person in charge who gave them the survey leaves, goes into the next room. A few minutes later, there's a loud crash and the screams of pain and crying and say, my leg, ouch, ouch, ouch. And, you know, what happens subsequently? The question is, did the participant do anything to help? You know, cry out, can I get someone to help you, or run into the next room or not? And it seemed like if it was a compassionate person, a highly virtuous person, they would tend to help, and their helping wouldn't vary as a function of what the stranger with them did.
Mm-hmm.
But lo and behold, for actual participants, it did vary considerably. So if the stranger with them does nothing, just keeps working on the survey as if there's no emergency at all, by and large, you know, this is no news, new news, is very famous research, by and large, the participants won't help either. So in that particular study, only 7% of participants did anything at all to help, as compared to another version where they were alone with no stranger at all, and in that version, 70% helped. So it seemed like their behavior was quite sensitive to what another person in the room was doing. And in particular, the underlying story has to do with factors of embarrassment, fear of embarrassment, and not the most important moral considerations. So that seems to me to reflect somewhat badly on character. I wouldn't draw grandiose lessons from that. One study doesn't prove anything here. I'm just giving you a kind of an illustration of one of the more depressing or disappointing results that I came across. On the flip side, with helping, I'm really impressed with the work of Daniel Batson, who was at Kansas for most of his career, and is one of the leading researchers on the topic of empathy and helping. It's long been known that when you increase participants' empathy, they subsequently are much more likely to help. There's an empathy-helping relationship. That's no big discovery. But Batson, you know, one of his claims to fame in the research world is to try and come up with an explanatory hypothesis for why empathy tends to lead to higher levels of helping behavior. And his proposal, the empathy altruism hypothesis, proposes that the motivation that's induced by feeling empathy is genuinely altruistic motivation. It's motivation concerned with benefiting others for their own sake, independent of whether I, the actor, benefit or not. So in one of his studies, these are college students. They had an opportunity to help what they were told was a fellow member of their university who they'd never come across and who had been in a terrible car wreck and was in need of a tremendous amount of help in order to be able to graduate from the university. And it's cut through the details just to get to the punchline. Control subjects, by and large, did not sign up to help. Those who had been given a different two-sentence manipulation in the instructions, by and large, did sign up to help. This Katie Banks, this allegedly fellow student at the university. And then Batson's right. Not only are they acting more helpfully because of the empathy manipulation, but their motivation to help is altruistic. That's the kind of motivation I would expect of a virtuous person, of a compassionate person in particular. So, to summarize and then I'll stop, when I looked at this literature and helping, I saw two kind of sides of it. A kind of more discouraging side where there's evidence of lack of helping, not for very good reasons, and a more positive side where there's evidence of helping, and in some cases when it's empathetic helping, for quite good reasons. And so no surprise then at that point I drew the conclusion that we're a rather mixed bag in between in between the poles of virtue and vice, or in this case, compassion and callousness.
Sure. How much did you look at individual difference moderators?
Very little. Tell me more about why I probably should have.
Well, I'm a personality researcher, so
right.
You know, like clearly, certainly make conclusions about humans on average, but you know, there's certain people who are persistently, consistently more along the lines of the antagonism spectrum, and there are those who are more agreeable, and has a lot of predictive value as well.
So I mean, two things. One, I'm not conducting the studies myself. Again, I'm a philosopher reading the research, so I'm kind of relying on what the studies themselves did in terms of measuring individual differences. But then secondly, my view, and I really want to stress this, because sometimes it can come across as I'm just lumping everyone into one box and saying, well, in this kind of situation, everyone's going to behave this way. In this other kind of situation, everyone's going to behave this other way. No, I mean, that never turned out to be the case. In the individual situations, there were always individual differences in the behavior that was found. And my own, you know, overall view here is that there's going to be a spectrum. So there's going to be, you know, if we're comfortable with categorical labels here, which sometimes we're not, fine, especially talking to psychologists, but if we're comfortable with categorical labels here, there's, you know, the virtue side of things, there's the vice side of things, there's this middle space in between virtue and vice, or using the example I just had, compassion and callousness. And my reading of the literature, my takeaway is that while many people are in this middle space, not all are. They're going to be outliers on both ends. So you're going to have, you know, your Hitlers on the one end, you're going to have your Gandhis on the other. And that's why the cover of the latest book, The Character Gap, has, you know, precisely on the cover, Gandhi on the top and Hitler on the bottom. So just to emphasize that it's not all just monolithic here. There's a nice, or I think it's plausible to think that people fall on a spectrum of virtue and vice.
Gotcha. Okay, so what about harming?
Yeah, so same kind of story here. So it follows the same kind of scripts, but I use different examples. So the main one that I focus on this, you know, in this element of my research and in wrote about it in The Character Gap, the trade book, was the Milgram experiment. So, you know, don't have to say much about that for your listeners. But interestingly, even in the Milgram experiment, it's not, I don't think the right lesson to draw is a really pessimistic, negative, vicious kind of conclusion. Some people do draw that. I mean, they see, wow, you know, these participants came in here, and within the span of this one session, they essentially were willing to kill an innocent person, an innocent stranger. Boy, isn't that just a bad reflection on their character? Aren't they, you know, vicious? And if we're like them, aren't we vicious too? In this context, aren't we malevolent or cruel or a little like that? So it's easy to take I think a lot of this harming literature in that direction, in a more pessimistic direction. So maybe it's worth to highlight, kind of counterbalance that with, even in Milgram, it's a mixed bag. Mm. So, you know, kind of famously, he had other variations rather than the one that, you know, most intro students encounter. So he had variations where there was no authority figure, or he had variations where there was conflicting instruction from the authority figure, or there had variations where there was authority figure, but not in the same room. And what we see in those, many of those variations, is that the shock level goes way down. In other words, participants aren't nearly as inclined to turn the dial up and up and up and up, and up to the XXX level. And in many cases, they keep it at a very moderate level. So that's one point. Even though they had free rein, it was up to them. They could have continued on to the XXX level and these other variations if they so chose to do so. They tended not to choose to do so. And then there's a second point to make here, which is that even in the famous version, it's not as if, as far as we can tell, the participants were kind of wholeheartedly on board with what they were doing. They would need to be if they were vicious. Because one aspect of a vice is a wholehearted motivation, a lack of conflict in one's motivation. So one's beliefs and desires and feelings and so forth line up in a certain direction. And that's also true of a virtue, too. A virtuous person is wholehearted. So if that's right, then we would need to see that in the participants in the Milgram study to draw the conclusion if they were cruel or any other label you wanted to use. But as far as I can tell, we didn't see that. Hmm. What instead we saw was evidence of conflict, of internal stress, sometimes even external, you know, evidence like sweating and, you know, shaking and nervousness and this kind of thing, which would suggest a deep internal conflict that was going on. Mm. And that's what you would expect the psychological profile of a vicious person to be.
Mm. Yeah. So interesting. And then very similar findings for lying and cheating?
The same pattern, but I think some really cool, innovative studies. Maybe I'll just pick up on the cheating for one more illustration. Those examples I gave you from harming and helping tended to be older examples, not to take anything away from them. But in the case of cheating, there's this body of research in the last 10 years that uses a certain kind of paradigm to investigate the level of honesty in the participants. And it goes as follows. You have a control group. They're taking a test with 20 problems. They're told that they're going to be paid, say, 50 cents per correct answer on the test. In this control condition, they just work as hard as they can. They turn in their answers. The authority figure or the experimenter, whoever it is in charge, grades the test and pays them accordingly. So there's no opportunity to cheat. But then there's this other variation where it's now called the shredder condition. Very similar in some ways, 50 cents per correct answer, same test, different participants. But the key variation is that they're told after they take the test that they will be the ones to grade the test themselves. Mm. They'll then just be told, they're told their materials will be shredded or destroyed, and they can just verbally report how many they got correct in quotation marks, so we should keep in mind. And so this provides a space to cheat if one wants to and get away with it if one wants to. So naturally, in many contexts, people don't cheat because they're afraid of getting caught and the punishment might come with it. But in this context, you can cheat if you want to and get away with it, no questions asked, or so one might think. So what are the results here? It tends to be that controls, you know, it varies from various study to study. You know, one study, 7 correct out of 20. Different group now, the shredder condition for this particular study, 14 correct in quotation marks, that we should say correct in that shredder condition for that particular study. So double. Now, is it because that this second group was just so much smarter? They did so much, you know, they were really, really good at that test. And so that's why they got 14 right as opposed to 7. You know, that's possible, but I'm not going to wager any money on that. I'm not going to buy that explanation. I'm going to buy the other natural explanation that they probably saw an opportunity to make some money. And then it goes on from there. Because again, this might give you some pessimistic conclusions, right? Or lead you in a pessimistic direction. You know, oh boy, I might have thought people were honest, but then I see this study and now I'm thinking a lot of people are dishonest. Well, you know, first of all, don't draw any big conclusions from one study. But secondly, there are now interesting spin-offs and variations, iterations of it. So I'll just mention one more. You can do the same thing, but where by same thing, I mean have this shredder condition set up, but do it at a university with an honor code where, for example, my university, Wake Forest, we have an honor code here. And so what happens if before they take the test, the participants, in this case, would it be college students, sign their university's honor code, then they take the test, same test, same 50%, 50 cents correct answer incentive, and same opportunity to cheat if you want to because your answer key is going to be shredded. Well, in this one study, cheating disappeared. Mm. The average performance went back down to the control levels. So I see something like that, and I say, wait a minute here. That's a little bit different than I would expect of a dishonest person. I would expect a dishonest person to maybe sign the honor code as a formality. Yeah, I mean, of course, I got to do that. Everyone else is doing that. But then turn around and cheat. Take advantage of the same opportunity to cheat that they would have had without the honor code. But lo and behold, that's not, at least this one study, suggests. That's not what's going to happen. Of course, we need to see some replication too.
Wow. So there's hope for humanity.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's hope if you have an assumption working in the back of the discussion. So right now, the picture I've articulated is one where we've kind of got a mixed character, is what I call a mixed character, kind of mixed bag. It's hope there in the sense that we're not as bad as we could be, but it's also, you know, disappointment in that we're not nearly as good as we should be. But there's another kind of discussion of hope here, which is about change, right? Is there any hope, even if we are a mixed bag or tend to be, like myself included, is there any hope to be found in moving the needle to try and get better and get closer to that ideal of virtue? And this will rely on an assumption that personality is malleable.
Right.
And I know you've argued that it is. Everything I've read suggested it is. Philosophers, you know, going all the way back to Plato and Aristotle, have always thought that personality is malleable. By that I mean it can change even if it's not going to be overnight or, you know, some magic pill or anything like that. Slow, gradual change is possible. So if we take that assumption and combine it with this mixed bag idea, then, you know, I think that the natural question to ask is, well, are there any strategies or steps or, you know, approaches we can adopt to gradually, slowly change in the right direction?
That's a good question.
Yeah. So I have some things I might say about that. You know, first of all, I hope so. You know, it'd be a real shame if there aren't, right? I mean, you know, if we just say, oh, here's how things are.
Yeah.
And by the way, your personality and you know, specifically your character can change, but, you know, good luck.
Yeah.
Go figure it out. But I think there are some ideas that do show some promise. When I want to carefully kind of qualify, I don't say they're infallible or they're guaranteed to produce results or anything like that. So in the last part of the trade book, Character Gap, I go over about 6 or 7 such strategies, and some of them I say they don't look very promising to me. So, for example, the strategy of labeling people as virtuous, even if you don't think they are. That's a strategy. You know, you could say to kids or to adults, you know, you're a really compassionate person, or you're a really, you know, courageous person, even though you don't think that. Just in the hope of getting them to accept that label about themselves and then try to conform their behavior more to that label. That is an actual strategy out there that's been discussed. I'm not so positive about that one for reasons I can elaborate if you like, but just to give you, just to throw one out there. I go on though and isolate a couple strategies that I think are more promising. So one has to do with moral, and again, I'm focusing on moral character, moral role models, exemplars, heroes, saints, and the like of that, whether these are fictional, like Priest and Les Mis, or whether they're actual people, whether they're more historical, actual people like Abraham Lincoln, Harriet Tubman, or whether they're contemporary people, whether they're like prominent in society, or whether they're our neighbor next door. You know, there are different variations or different ways this can go. But the basic idea is, if we come to admire someone for their honesty, let's say, and that admiration, that emotion of admiration, inspires in us a desire to emulate them, to try to become more like them. What Haidt, you know, talked about is this feeling of elevation. That could lead over time, the hope is, to gradually becoming more like them, right? So if I admire Lincoln for his honesty, and that inspires in me a desire to become more like him, to emulate him for his honesty, then over time, when I'm confronted with different situations, I could try to think, you know, what might he do in this situation, or how can I be like more like Lincoln in this situation? And that can be an aspirational aim that I gradually get closer and closer to approximating. So I could say more about that. That's just one example. And I'll give you one other one of a strategy that I think shows some promise. And that's educating ourselves more about some of the tendencies that we tend to have in opposition to virtue that hold us back from being virtuous. So we mentioned already, for example, the group effect and how in groups, even when an emergency is going on, It's fairly clear that an emergency is going on. People sometimes don't help.
No.
Well, that's striking. It's surprising to many. You ask lay people, what would you predict would happen? Or what would you predict you would do in that situation? And, overwhelmingly, people say, I would help, or the group would help. And then often that doesn't manifest itself. Why? Well, one leading explanation is that we are quite moved by considerations of embarrassment more than we realize, where we have this fear of embarrassing ourselves in group contexts, and that can hold us back and restrict us from doing the right thing, in this case, helping a stranger in an emergency. Well, what if we became more aware of that? What if we learned about some of the research or became more introspective or, discovered some of these tendencies about ourselves, so we're just aware of them in the first place, and then in situations where they might come into a play, we can counterbalance them. We can hold them in check. So if, in the future, we're in a situation where someone needs help and we're in a group context and I feel myself holding back and being reticent, I can also remind myself, well, why? Is this really, worth me blending into the crowd? Or should I step up? Is there any good reason not to step up in that situation and do the right thing? So role models seem promising, and what I call getting the word out and learning more about our tendencies, which hold us back, seems promising as well.
Yeah, maybe that could be incorporated into education, K-12.
I think both could be, and both in some cases are. Some schools do this intentionally. I mean, in one sense, the role modeling is happening already across the board, whether we think about it or not. I mean, teachers already are serving as role models, and the values that they're espousing to their students and the way they're living their lives in front of their students is serving a role modeling function, even if the school itself or the teacher in particular never gave any thought to character role modeling in the first place. So
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. I try my best to model for students the characteristics that I want them to try to develop, but it's not easy.
Right. That's right.
It's not easy, especially when students are not there yet and they're not modeling it back.
Right, for sure.
It can be very hard to remain at a sort of higher level of wisdom and compassion and loving kindness when someone's not showing that in return.
That's right. You're absolutely right. And I try to do the same thing myself in a variety of different contexts. So I try to do that with my students. I also have young children. So I'm trying to do that.
Well, sometimes they're the same thing. Sometimes.
I don't want to get in trouble with my university here. But I also try and do it, by discipline. So in my marriage, there are lots of times when I'm trying to live out what I care about, but while acknowledging that I have a lot of room to grow, and I'm a very flawed and mixed bag myself.
Yeah.
Well,
it's interesting. I mean, welcome to the club. But I've been thinking about individual differences, and I feel like there's like three latent classes of that we could identify. And I've been thinking about constructing a scale to get at this, and I don't think anyone's ever gotten this. But let me know if you think this makes any sense. It feels like there are people who have more of a conflict between the dark and light forces within. There are those that seem to have accepted their dark side and embrace it almost fully. And there are those that are more unleashed on the light side and just don't have as much of the conflicts in their daily life. Like, they're not constantly battling, should I be a nice person or shouldn't? It just comes more naturally to them that, of course, I want to. I have the empathy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think anyone's really done a good job capturing the conflict of the force as an individual differences variable.
Right, yeah. But you'll find plenty of resources in philosophy.
Oh, that's for sure. Throughout the course of human history, there's a lot of stories.
Yeah. But great empirical stories throughout history. There's also just great conceptual work by philosophers too. So, one way to describe what you're saying there is what Aristotle used as his taxonomy of character. So, for Aristotle, he had four. This is simplifying, and he had more than four, but Let's just keep it simple initially. He had four categories of character. He had virtue, he had continence or strength of will, incontinence or weakness of will, and then vice.
Mm.
And so you have three categories there. But interestingly, the virtue, that's wholeheartedly oriented towards the light, to use your terminology. There's no conflict in the virtuous person. They're wholeheartedly oriented in a certain direction. The vicious person similarly is wholeheartedly oriented, but of course in the opposite direction, towards the dark. And then for the continent and incontinent, what do they have in common? They're both conflicted. And the difference in them, of course, is how they resolve the conflict.
Right, and that's right.
Kind of
more power comes in as another moderator there.
So the kind of person resolves the conflict in favor of the right thing. The incontinent person resolves the conflict in favor of the wrong thing or the bad thing, but they're both conflicted. So in a sense, you and Aristotle seem to be on the same page.
Oh, let's end on that note. let's let that sit there for eternity. Hey, thank you so much for chatting with me today and for your real pioneer, truly pioneering work integrating positive psychology and philosophy.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, please add a rating and review of the Psychology Podcast on iTunes. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the podcast, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.